Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and welcome to another great episode here of Suspense Radio. I am your host, John Robb, and today's show, we are going to have a killer one for you, pun intended. First up is going to be author Tess Garrison, followed by best-selling author John Land, Boyd Morrison, and Robert Logan. So sit back, relax, and enjoy, because 2 hours of Suspense Radio starts right now. Back here for another episode of Suspense Radio. Again, I'm your host, John Robb. First up, we are going to bring on our first guest here, which is none other than international best-selling author Tess Garrison, famous, of course, for the Rizzoli and Isles series, which is now on TNT on the TV show. I believe they're into their second season, going into their third season. So, Tess, thank you so much for coming on. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. And they are on their third season, going into their fourth season.
They're on their third season. It's tough with the TNTs when they're not, like, on the regular show because their schedules are a little bit different, how they kind of do things. So it's kind of odd. But, fourth season going on. And I know that after the first one, just being here in Hollywood, the talk was, are they going to make it? Are they going to go to the second one? And bam, here we are with the fourth season. And it's just been fabulous. Speaking of that, you were just out here in Anaheim visiting the set of Rizzoli and Isles. How was that experience?
It was just fabulous. You know, what I'm reminded of is how much hard work goes into making a TV show. As writers, we get to sit in our rooms and not talk to anybody and control our universe. You get out to a film set and suddenly you're juggling 75 people, and it's like running a little war, in fact. So I'm really appreciative of getting back to my quiet office.
Yeah, it's like kind of we talked about off the air just a little bit, was we were on the set of a trailer watching, and if they could just turn, you know, that camera around to show the hundred of people that are behind there actually having to be very quiet and watch everything and the lighting and the people above that you don't see, it is quite an amazing feat, and I don't even know how they would do it on one of those big blockbuster movies, like a Transformers or something. I mean,
right.
It's just got to be massive people.
Yeah, so, you know, the film industry, when I get out there, I'm full of respect for the work they do, everybody, from the makeup people to the people who, you know, work with the costumes, to the lighting. It's just everybody is good at what they do.
And do they still kind of ask you, are you still, you know, kind of consulted about ideas and how things are going, and do they ask you about maybe the progression of the characters and things like that? How much input do you still have in the making of the TV show and the stories maybe behind it?
Well, they are running on their own parallel track. They have their own idea of where the characters are going, so they don't really need me, and I don't provide them any kind of guidance. I have my own universe going on with the books, and I know that some readers are sort of confused when they go back and forth between the TV show and the books, but in a way, I know my philosophy is I wrote the melody, and they are just taking it. They're doing a little stylistic differences, and so you're seeing the rap version on TV, and, you know, I wrote the classical version.
That's kind of a neat way to put it. Yeah, they got more of the hip hop, you got more of the classical. And
right.
You know, speaking of that, you're coming out at the end of August with the latest Rizzoli and Isles book called Last to Die. And so how, you know, what was the kind of the behind the scenes in the book? Can you kind of give the listeners a little bit about what they can expect?
Right. When I was a little girl, I wanted to be a crime fighter. I was 10 years old, and I got my first fingerprint kit, and I made a mess of the house. My mom said no more. But I've always been interested in the idea of that ordinary people can do extraordinary things, that children are capable of far more than we give them credit for. So I wanted to write a book where children are an important part of solving the crime. And in Last to Die, there are three orphans who are taken to the Evensong boarding school. It's a mysterious boarding school in Maine. The reason they're brought there is that all three of them survived two separate massacres, and the killer still seems to want them dead. So Jane and Maura bring them out to Evensong, where they are kept safe, and there things begin to happen. Things begin to go wrong. And it's really going to be the children who provide the vital clue, the kids who are amateur sleuths and help the big city cops solve the crime.
Now, how old are the children? Are they kind of different ages? Are they all kind of the same age? Did you have them all around the same age?
Well, the three kids that are at the center of the story are 13 and 14, and it's a girl and two boys. And they're all misfits. They're funny little misfits in a way. The girl has a brain disorder because she got shot in the head once and survived, so she doesn't sleep. This girl wanders all night. And then one of the boys is an amateur astronomer, so he's kind of chunky and pale, and he stays up all night too. And they're the kids that nobody really wants to hang out with, but they're really smart.
And when you're kind of writing kids, and I've kind of done it maybe a little in short stories, it was actually kind of a therapeutic thing for me because I was able to put in some of the things that they did, and I was like, yeah, I actually did that. And it was kind of a soft way to tell my parents, yeah, I did those things, but now I'm writing them, so don't worry about it because I'm okay now. Is that kind of one of the things you can do?
Well, I think that what I was playing on, and I often play with this in my books, is the sense of children who don't feel like they belong anywhere. Kids who feel
right.
like outsiders. I mean, I was the only Asian kid in my entire elementary school, so I never fit in. I was always the weird one. And this is what these kids are going through. They're the weird ones, and they're struggling to be accepted.
And how does, when you're sitting here talking, how does Rizzoli and Isles kind of be able to, you know, kind of fit in? Is it a little different because you've never really done it with children before? So this is kind of an emotional stretch for those characters also that you've been able to do. How was that kind of writing, influential in the book?
Well, Jane Rizzoli in the book is a mother. She has a toddler, and so it's this becomes more emotional for her because she knows what it's like to lose a to be afraid of losing your child, and she becomes emotionally attached to these children. Maura, who is childless and unmarried, has, however, a relationship with a 16-year-old boy. She's sort of semi-adopted. His name is Rat, and she met him in a couple books ago in Ice Cold when he saved her life in Wyoming. It turns out that Rat is also staying at this school. This is his boarding school. So all these, these young people from either the current case or from a past case are all brought together under one roof.
Yeah, and what I kind of meant by more the emotional is just because whenever you have children at the forefront and they're the ones. And, of course, it's every mother's nightmare. You know, those are the ones that are in the center of the crosshairs of what's going on. It always makes it a little bit – it's almost like you have to be a little darker as an author because since you are a mother and those kinds of things, it makes it a little more difficult, I think, to write because it touches in a different kind of – in a different way.
Yeah, no, I understand what you mean. Yeah,
this is
one of my unspoken rules is I never kill a major child character. I never do.
Right.
So
yeah,
in a way, that's kind of a clue that nothing's bad is going to happen to these three kids in this story, even though you think it's going to happen. But I don't like to kill children. What I do like to write about, though, is children as heroes, children who are the powerless, who fight back and do things that nobody expects of them. That is a fun journey, and I think that I think children like reading about themselves as heroes, even though they really have no power in society.
And I want to remind everybody here, we're speaking with author Tess Gerritsen, and her website is tessgerritsen.com, and we're talking about the book coming out August 28th, called Last to Die, which is the next book in the Rizzoli and Isle series. And your three characters here, you have Teddy, you have Will, you have Claire. Was that your intention to have three children? Was your intention to maybe have one or two and then a third kind of came on? Was there any kind of surprises while you were kind of putting the book together about the three that came out that you didn't expect would happen when you were finished?
Well, the surprises usually come in their character development. I always knew I wanted to have three children at the center, and I knew that Claire was going to be the important one because, you know, she's a nasty teenager. She's a 13-year-old that who's that head injured kid who is still manages to be pretty clever, and she's also the kid who takes chances, and so she's going to be really important when it comes to solving the crime. I like the idea of three children who are so different from each other, so completely different, that the only thing that links them is that they all feel like they're oddballs and they have to stick together. So what the surprises that came in for me had to do with the personality of Will, who is the 14-year-old boy who's an amateur astronomer. I didn't know at first who he was, and then as he started to write, I realized he's a fat kid. He's a kid that is always teased and called the great white whale, and he turns out to be a hero as well. And he actually turns out to be something of almost a romantic figure in Claire's life.
And the other thing that people might want to understand, when they go to your website, they're going to see a little blurb in the bottom left-hand corner about Rizzoli and Isles, which you wrote a short story also called John Doe. Now, what was kind of the concept behind wanting to write a short story? And I know that the ebook craze is making it so much easier for authors to be able to do. And is this kind of a bridge, or was this kind of a story that you felt was good enough to be written, but maybe not a full-length novel, but something that was, you know, quick bang, boom, you know, right into, you know, fit within the characters?
Well, I had this idea. I thought, wouldn't it be, okay, here's a concept that came to me. Maura Isles loses her memory one night, and she doesn't know whether she killed somebody. You know, that was the basic core of the story. And I thought, oh, that sounds really cool. I want to see what happens. But I didn't feel it was a whole book, and I wanted to turn this in really quick. And I ended up writing it in 2 weeks. The story is that Maura goes to a cocktail party. A gorgeous man hands her a glass of champagne. She drinks it, and she wakes up the next morning on her living room sofa and doesn't know what happened. But what has happened in the meantime is Boston PD has found a dead man, stabbed to death. Maura's address is in his pocket, and it is the man she met at the cocktail party. So now Maura is suspect number one, and she does not know whether she killed him or not. It was that immediate, you know, situation that got me hooked into it, and I just wanted to write it, and I didn't want to have to be bothered with turning it into a whole 400-page manuscript.
And I think that's it is available on ebook, and people can find it Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the places, and it's out now. And that is one of the cool things that you are able to do with ebook in the electronic age, is give those little snippets, something where it's like, you got a great idea, and instead of maybe having to turn into a whole book, you can just bring it out, you know, short story, and it gives just more depth and just a little bit more added to the adventures of Rizzoli and Isles and what they've been doing.
Right, and it allowed me to explore the fact that these two women really, you know, they really do have each other's backs. So Jane is working, you know, flat out trying to prove that Maura is innocent. This is because this is her best friend. This is, I mean, other than her husband, this is her best friend. So once again, we get to see two women supporting each other, and I think this is part of what explains why the TV show Rizzoli and Isles is such a huge hit. We don't see many TV shows like this. We haven't seen this explored much in fiction, the idea that women can be buddies and women can not only be competent but trust each other to save each other's lives. I mean, we hear about men doing that all the time, but women, this is new.
Right. I mean, just in the thrill of genre, and just to go back and think, you know, I'm thinking of like two women. The only thing that I can kind of come up with that was even not even really that close, but two women that were that prominent in TV was like Cagney and Lacey.
Right.
That was a long time ago.
Right, and the only other one I can think of in the meantime is Xena. Xena,
oh, yeah.
And Gabrielle. Right, I mean, two women warriors. So it's really this idea of competent women who are willing to give their lives for each other because they're so loyal. All the other TV shows are all about women's rivalries. I mean, think about the Jersey Girls and you know, Housewives, and it's all about backstabbing. This is about women really holding each other up.
Now, for people that might be new to the Rizzoli and Isles, maybe they just know the TV show and then all of a sudden they're going back and they're like, you know, oh my God, I had no idea that, you know, there was 10 books already written about this. Do you recommend that they go back and start with the book that started it all, The Surgeon? Can they go ahead, since they kind of been watching the TV show, pick up Last to Die and be able to just fall right in and then kind of go back and read some of the other ones? What would you recommend to those fans who are just kind of getting into maybe the book version of the characters?
I think you can pick up the books at any point in the series, and I think I have enough backstory so you can figure out what happened before. If you want to go to the beginning of the series, the first book in which both Jane and Maura show up is The Apprentice, which is the second book. And the reason it only becomes a partnership after the second book is I never intended to write a series.
I know, we talked about that before.
Yeah, I mean, I started off writing The Surgeon, Jane Rizzoli was supposed to die, she didn't die, and I just wanted to know what happened next. So every book
Goodbye.
I've ever written, yeah. Every book I've ever written has always been to find out what happens next. I have no idea, and I find out as I write the books.
So, yeah, so basically they can go ahead and they don't have to, you know, pick up Last, you know, they can go right into Last to Die, kind of go back if they want to and
yeah.
experience, you know, everything that goes on. And I think that that's the best way that you were able to, you know, treat the series was not make it where, you know, all of a sudden you're 10 books in and then people are like, oh, I'm not going to read all 10 books. I don't want to start back at the beginning. But they don't have to do that, and that's the good thing.
Yeah, and each book is its own mystery novel. So even if you don't want to read all of them, you can hunt and peck, and you'll still get a complete story with each book.
Yeah, and the other, you get a lot of emails. People are kind of wondering, like, when's your medical thrillers? You're going to kind of do those again? Because, you know, you have 4 medical thrillers that were out. The last was The Bone Garden.
Yeah.
You
get emails from readers who want this, they want that. I have a number who say, I want your own medical thrillers. A couple who say, I would really love another book like Gravity, which seems to be the favorite of every male reader of mine. But right now, my contract calls for Rizzoli and Isles books specifically, so I'm going to be writing those for a while.
And I think, and that's what is a lot of people have to understand, that you just, once you're in with, you know, publishers and things like that, you just can't go ahead and say, well, I'm just going to write whatever I want to. It doesn't really work that way.
No, it's because...
I think a lot of authors need to know that.
Yeah, I mean, publishers know which books sell the best, and if a particular series sells the best, that's what they want more of.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's why you see a lot of people, when they start writing series and the character gets popular, that's what they continue to do, because that's what the publisher wants you, you know, to write. But that's not saying that you can't go ahead and write a medical short story or something there,
right.
You know, back and forth. But that's, you know, but you have so many other things you're doing. I mean, I don't know where you're going to find the time anyway.
That would be off the contract. I would have to be doing that on my own time, and then I would have to sell it as if it were a completely different book. So it's, you know, there are times when I understand why Conan Doyle wanted to kill off Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah.
He wanted to do something different. And the trouble is, when in today's market for publishing, they want a book very, very quickly, and there's not much chance to do something completely different. But I'm playing around with an idea, a young adult book, and I'm having fun with it.
Do you ever go back, and again, we're speaking here with author Tess Gerritsen, and the latest book is Last to Die in the Rizzoli and Isles series, book 10, or if you want to say book 9 when they've kind of both showed up, you can say that too. But do you ever go back and kind of look back at the series and say, you know what, there's a character in here that I really like to maybe explore a little bit more, and you're going to maybe bring back out. Do you ever think about doing something like that? Does that ever come to your mind?
Oh, yeah, all the time. And, in fact, this is kind of how the series it has developed. I mean, I introduced a man named Anthony Sansone back sixth book, and he has been recurring. And then Rat has come in Ice Cold, and now he's recurring. So it really depends on how much I think these characters are integrated into Jane and Maura's lives. If they become important to Jane and Maura, they become important to the series.
And the other thing that a lot of people might want to know is that, you know, we were talking off air, and you said, I want to get a handle on my schedule, because you've been going all over the place, you know, back and forth, and it looks like here, coming up right after the book, that you're going to be doing some appearances also, of course, starting with the book launch, and you're going to be going to a lot of cities, August 28th through September 14th. You're going, some people just stay in a certain area, but I mean, you're going as far as from Boston to Cincinnati to Los Angeles all the way to New Hampshire.
Right.
How is that getting control of your schedule?
Well, luckily, that book tour is only about 2.5 weeks, so I'm happy about that. The real scheduling problems are because of the international markets. I mean, I'm pretty big overseas, so last year I realized I was overseas for about 3 months out of the year in various countries promoting books. And that's what takes a lot of time, a lot of energy away from writing, because I really need to be at my desk to write. I'm not so good writing on the road. On the road, I just want to go to sleep.
Right. I mean, is that kind of like your superstition? Do you have any kind of writing superstitions? Do you bring like a little stuffed animal with you, even if you're on the road, and
No.
sits next to your computer to help you write or anything like that?
No, I don't have any superstitions. I think my real issue is that when you're traveling across time zones, you get very tired, and at the end of the day, I just want to watch TV or read some stupid magazine. So, and the creative juices leach out of you somehow, but you don't realize that things are still percolating. And sometimes, if I've hit a really tough plot point, travel helps because I get away from my own environment and I will get an inspiration, an idea to fix the plot issue or to come up with a new story. So in that sense, travel is important. It's not really when you do your grunt work, you know, the writing day to day. It's when you get your inspiration. That's what travel does for me.
And is the website going to be updated soon with the exact date and where you're going to be exactly?
Yeah.
Right now, just kind of list the cities.
Yes, it will. I don't have the exact final schedule yet, but as soon as I do, I'll start putting up details. I mean, I do know which cities I'm going to, but I don't
right.
know all the times, et cetera.
Now, the one thing that everybody kind of talks about is where is publishing going?
Ah.
And that's the big question you get. And you might get that, you know, they might ask you because you've been in this now for so long. You've seen how it started and now the gamut to kind of where it's at now. Do you have a sense maybe in 5 years, do you have any idea maybe where publishing is going to be?
You know, it's always tricky to make predictions, but I think that everybody is now self-publishing. I mean, people who don't want to fuss with agents and editors and regular publishers are self-publishing. So what we've gotten is this huge number of material, all this content that's sitting on Kindle and Nook, and the consumer's confused, doesn't know where to go or what book is worthwhile picking up. I think we're going to bounce back to the idea that publishers are kind of the gatekeepers, that maybe if it has, Simon & Schuster or Random House on, you know, as a guarantee of a good read, that readers are going to want to go back to that. So we're bouncing back and forth here. I do think it's the best time ever, though, to be a writer. Everybody wants content, and you can't get a computer to do that for you. You have to have a human being put that together.
And do you get more emails now than ever from authors saying, can you please read my book? Can you please review it? I mean, does that now, because
yeah.
It probably didn't happen as much before, but now with all the self-published and everybody trying to do, they might be contacting, can you read my book? Can you review? I mean, is that just starting to happen a lot more and more now?
I'm overwhelmed. I've just started saying, no, I can't, because what happens is when I say yes, I end up getting 25 galleys, and then I don't get a chance to read them, and then I feel guilty. So
yeah.
I think guilt is the big thing that I get when I can't read something that somebody has taken the money to send to me. So I have generally been saying no.
And just so everybody knows, if you're listening, the answer is no. So don't go ahead and write and ask Pat to read it. She just doesn't have the time. Because if she keeps reading all the books, she's not going to be able to write books. And I think that's the one
yeah.
thing that people got to know.
And time is tough enough.
Yeah, absolutely. And so now you're on pace probably. Are you going to be now like on pace every year? Is this going to be like around your time, end of August, that people can start expecting, the next books? Because publishers kind of put authors in a certain category or a certain month, it seems, and it's
yeah.
like that's when they kind of come out.
No, I don't think so, because I have that's one thing I did manage to do for my contract was give myself a little extra time for the next book. So I will not be having one out next year. I'm instead going to kind of take a breath and smell the roses for a little bit. But
yeah.
I have the idea for the next book already well in hand, and I think it's just a matter of taking the time to write it. I know exactly what's going to happen.
Well, I'll tell you what, Tess, we want to thank you so much for coming on. It's always a pleasure to have you. You know, good luck on everything that you do. Keep us updated, because it's always fascinating just to kind of see where Rizzoli and Isles goes, where your brain goes, because it just works in just that kind of different way.
Okay.
And that's
thanks
the
a
best
lot.
Part of thrillers.
Yeah.
So, yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much, Tess. Enjoy yourself, and we'll talk with you later.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Again, everybody, that is author Tess Gerritsen, Rizzoli and Isles creator, you might know from the TV series TNT. But now's your chance to discover the books. Last to Die is the 10th in the series. You can go back. Silent Girl was before Ice Cold. Goes all the way back to The Surgeon, and like she said, The Apprentice was the first appearance of both of them together. And the book comes out, Lost to Die, on August the 28th. You can find it everywhere. You can also read the short story, John Doe, which is available in ebook form. And it's TessGerritsen.com to find out more information. Right now, we are going to play for you a book audio clip. It's by David Lyons, and it's called Ice Fire. And then we're going to be back on with John Land. So here you go.
Ice Fire by David Lyons. Narrated by Michael Kramer. Copyright 2012 by David Lyons. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Atria Books, a division of Simon & Schuster, Incorporated, and was produced in the year 2012 by Tantor Media, Incorporated, which holds the copyright there too. Prologue. One of the two men would die within the hour, the one who should have known better. They sat in a small office, identifiable as such only by the cheap desk in the middle of the room. There was no sign outside to indicate what purpose this anonymous space served. Bob Palmetto sat behind the desk. Unruly wisps of sparse blonde hair fell down his forehead, but received no attention. An occasional toss of his head kept the errant strands out of his eyes. He was extremely thin, as if eating were a routine largely ignored. His closely set eyes darted from the man sitting across from him to the tinted floor-to-ceiling glass wall, all that separated the room from the sidewalk and parking lot of a dingy strip mall. A frayed pea-green shag carpet sported coffee stains. In an old wooden chair across from the desk, lawyer Dexter Jessup sat in sport coat and tie, the tie loosened, a Windsor knot hanging at his throat. "Why'd you set that damn meeting for tomorrow afternoon? I need you in court with me," Palmetto said. "An attorney from my office will meet you in front of the federal building," Jessup said. "Her name is Ruth Kalin. Don't worry, she knows what to do." "I'm supposed to produce more documents," Palmetto told him. "Last time the judge said he'd throw me in jail if I didn't turn them over. He had two federal marshals just standing."
"I was there, Bob. Remember?"
"Sorry." Bob Palmetto looked down, studying the bony fingers splayed across his desk as if seeing them for the first time. "I wish I'd never started fighting this thing. They're too powerful." He looked up. "And what you're doing scares the hell out of me. What good is a dead lawyer to me?"
"I'm going to talk to the FBI, Bob, not the Mafia. I have proof of a federal judge accepting bribes, stealing your intellectual property. The bastard belongs in jail, not on the bench. I'm going to see he gets what he deserves, and you can finish what you've started. You're going to be a rich man."
Palmetto waved away this last remark. "My discovery is dangerous. If it gets in the wrong hands, the damage could be irreversible. I've got to make sure that doesn't happen." Dexter looked away from his client to the parking area outside. The afternoon sun hung low in the sky and was reflected in the windshields of less than a dozen cars, one of them his, casting blinding flashes of light. It was so incongruous. In a two-room office in a failed strip mall sat a man who had invented a process that could double the world's available fossil fuel deposits by withdrawing methane gas from the frozen subsea surface. A leading energy company was stealing from him, and using a federal court to do it. There was no doubt. Photos of surreptitious meetings with the judge, documents stolen from court files. Dexter had found this and more.
Tomorrow he would share his findings with the only people who could do something about it, the FBI. "I've got to go," Dexter said. He stood and extended a hand over the desk. "I might be late, but I'll see you in court tomorrow." Palmetto clasped the lawyer's hand, staring at it, speaking to it, not raising his eyes. "Be careful," he said. "Be damned careful." The lawyer's route from Palmetto's office took him due east toward downtown New Orleans. He knew the direction he was traveling because the sunset was in his rearview mirror. He adjusted it, rendering it useless for its intended purpose, but at least keeping the reflected sun from blinding him. 5 minutes later, the sun had dropped, and he readjusted his mirror. That's when he spotted the car behind him, a black Jeep Cherokee. He knew that car and its driver. What did he want now? Dexter slowed down. There was no other traffic on this little-used secondary road. The Jeep flashed its lights. It pulled up right on his tail and flashed again. He could see the driver waving one arm out the window, motioning him to pull over. He pulled over onto the shoulder and got out of his car, leaving the door open and the motor running. The driver of the Jeep also got out and moved toward him, a little too fast. There were less than 10 feet separating them. "What do you..." Dexter saw the gun in the man's hand. He turned and jumped toward his car's open door, but slipped on the loose gravel of the shoulder, falling painfully to one knee. His pursuer was on him in an instant. He felt the metal against the back of his head. He did not feel the bullet that blew out his brain. The body was left next to the car with the motor running, the radio playing the nation's number one pop single, "Ice, Ice, Baby." It was October 1990. For more than 2 decades, Dexter Jessup's death would be all but forgotten. Not by Bob Palmetto.
So welcome back, everybody. Again, that is a book by David Lyons. It is called Ice Fire. You can go out, search, and find out more information about David. Coming up after, we're going to have another, we'll have an excerpt we're going to read by Julie Kramer and Shunning Sarah. But now we want to bring on a very special guest and a friend of ours, John Land, is back, and he's back with his next Caitlin Strong book. It's called Strong Vengeance. John, thank you so much for coming on. How you doing?
I'm doing great, John. Thanks for having me.
So here we go. Caitlin Strong comes back in Strong Vengeance. Gotta love the name. Tell everybody a little bit about the book. You know, they might not know Caitlin or just trying to get into, you know, your stories and are finding out about you. Give them that little behind-the-scenes information.
Well, first off, Caitlin Strong is a female Texas Ranger, a fifth-generation Texas Ranger. Essentially, she is a modern-day gunfighter. That's what she is, even though she's not a gunman, but a gunwoman. And this is her fourth adventure, and this time out, Caitlin is on the trail and racing to stop homegrown Islamic terrorists who have a plot to kill millions.
And when you're, you know, when you have a thriller series and you have a woman that's kind of doing it, it's a little bit difficult because, you know, people always say, oh, the male-dominated series with thrillers. But Caitlin is much different, and you've written her very, very, you know, no pun intended, very strong character. And, you know, that's the one thing that the people, when they come out of the book, you kind of realize, you're like, wow, I mean, you know, John, just, you know, it's kind of very explosive. Does it make it more difficult, though, you know, trying to have to get over that when people always say, oh, well, thrillers are, you know, men-dominated characters and blah, 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 blah?
Well, you know, that's a great point, and you just touched on exactly how Caitlin was born. In a meeting up at a yearly meeting we have with the sales force and my publisher just to talk about trends and what I should think about doing, years ago the discussion came up, the point came up that thrillers are now, this is 5 years ago or so, where thrillers were by far the then and now the most popular genre, and 75-80% of all books are bought by women. And Tom Espensheet, who is head of mass market sales for my company, made the point that can anybody name a single action thriller hero who's a woman? In spite of the fact that thrillers are so popular and women buy books, nobody could name a female Jack Reacher, who, of course, is Lee Child's iconic hero. Nobody could name a female Mitch Rapp from Vince Flynn, a female Cotton Malone from Steve Berry. Nobody could do it. And right around that table, I said, what about, why don't I do something like this? And I'd always wanted to write about the Texas Rangers. So right then and there, I said, what about a series featuring a female Texas Ranger? And I think the key thing you're hinting at is, since I'm a man, will men and or women accept, number one, will women accept a man writing a woman? And will the male thriller audience accept a female protagonist? And I think the answer to that was pretty much supplied by you, in the sense that Caitlin is essentially an action hero. And there are plenty of male, you know, her bad boy outlaw lover, Court Wesley Masters, who occupies usually 50% of the book, well, he's a guy. So you have the best of both worlds. Because I think thriller readers read books for pace. They read books for story. I don't think they're as concerned as much with gender. What they want is something that a book they can't put down. And what I love about your comments before is, to just expand on them one step further, it's very easy for both men and women in books like Strong Vengeance to become emotionally vested with Caitlin and the other characters. And the more you respond to characters emotionally, whether they're men or women, the more you will love the series and love each book in the series.
Yeah, that was one thing that I touched on when the September issue of the magazine comes out and the letter from the editor. I basically broke down the four genres that we cover, which is suspense, mystery, thriller, horror. And people always wonder, well, what's the difference between suspense and thriller and mystery? This and that. And there are a lot of differences when you actually break down the books. And you're a thriller writer, and the biggest thing about thriller, like you just mentioned, is pace. It has to be fast. There has to be the action. Where the suspense can be psychological, it can be slow and build up and things like that. But you have to come out, which is what you do in your Strong series, is at the beginning you have to come out and you got to go bam, and you got to hit the reader dead in the face, to where after the first chapter they're just already out of breath, but they got to keep going. And
great.
That's the thing of a thriller writer.
You're 100% right, and let's take it a step further, and that would be, I love reading suspense, what would be called a suspense thriller, as opposed to a high action thriller. The Caitlin Strong books are action thrillers in the sense that I don't know, there's no real formula, but you are going to see a lot of gunfights. You are going to see a lot of action set pieces that, to me, were inspired by the Sean Connery James Bond movies. They're the ones that started this tradition of high action and raising the bar. And to be frank and to be honest about my writing process, because I know this is something you're interested in and your listeners are interested in, there are times in a book where I realize, hey, I haven't had any action for 100 pages or so. I need an action scene. Now, although I'm doing it as part of an instinct that tells me this is an action thriller, therefore I need an action scene, I make sure that those action scenes fit the fabric of the story, that there is suspenseful and fast-paced, in the sense that there is clearly a threat to Caitlin herself, as at the same time she is trying to stop a bigger threat to a far larger number of people. And I think that is also a qualification of this kind of thriller. The hero's life must be in danger for this kind of thriller to succeed. It's not a mystery in the sense that you just have someone investigating. Caitlin has to stop bad people from doing bad things. And in Strong Vengeance, those bad people are the worst of the worst. And those are homegrown terrorists who are trying to have this plot to murder millions of Americans, destroy, you know, countless, you know, acres. I don't want to give too much away, but it can be. It's a really scary book, in the sense that it might be a little too real and a little too close to what could happen.
Yeah, I want to remind everybody, we're speaking here with author John Land. It's johnlandbooks.com. Drop the H, JONLand.com. But and the book is Strong Vengeance, and it's the fourth here in the Caitlin Strong series. And the one thing, when you sit here and you read, just like you were talking about, and the thriller, I always qualify it this way, because you say that there's some downtime, and there has to be. And it's like a rock concert. They come out explosive, then they play the ballad, and you put the lighters in the air. Then they come right back up again, and then they have to go back down and play the ballad. And it's all a roller coaster, and that's the biggest thing that you do, is you take that big hill up, and then you plunge them down. But then you have to twist and turns, and just kind of are a little more relaxing before you hit the loop. And then the other loop. and then those kinds of things. And that's what makes your books in the Caitlin Strong series the absolute epitome of what a thriller is, because that's how they roll.
You know, it's a great point. And the fact is, you make me think of two things with regards to the Caitlin books. And one is, I don't outline. I literally write by the seat of my pants. I know where I'm going, but I don't know how I'm going to get there. It's kind of like what Jerry Garcia said, it's not the destination, it's the journey, and that's the case for me. But I know the pieces. I'm not sure of the connections or the twists. And the other challenge I have, and this is the real fun, the biggest challenge, but also the thing I have the most fun with in the Caitlin Strong books, there's always a historical subplot that somehow connects to the present. For example, in Strong Vengeance, the book opens with Jean Lafitte and his business partner, something very few people realize. The great Texas hero Jim Bowie was the business partner of the pirate Jean Lafitte. And the opening of Strong Vengeance, you see them doing what they were doing back in the early 1800s, and that is raiding slave ships, stealing the slaves, and selling them, you know, off Galveston Island. This is all true. I didn't make it up. Well, in the book, that historical subplot becomes crucial, because the lost treasure of Jean Lafitte, the famous pirate, is what leads to a mass murder in 1979 that remained unsolved for 30 years that must be solved by Caitlin in order for her to get to the bottom of what's going on in the present. And the two Texas Rangers who failed to solve it originally were her legendary grandfather and father. So here it is, on top of everything else that's going on in Caitlin in Strong Vengeance, for her to stop the homegrown terrorists, she first has to solve a 30-year-old mass murder the solution of which eluded her grandfather and father. And I love tying in history with the present. There's no better quote ever spoken than William Faulkner, who said, "The past isn't dead, it's not even past." And I couldn't agree with that more. And I think that's one of the things that makes these books so much fun.
And the one thing that you mentioned that a lot of young authors scratch their head, because of course it's always been instilled in their brain, is to outline and know what you're doing and make sure you have everything together and put it all in nice little pieces and follow your outline when you're writing your book, because it'll make it easier. I call that hogwash, because I think that if you pigeonhole yourself into a way that when you're in the outlining, that when you start writing the book, when you get different ideas, your outline is now either you follow it or you blow it up and you just go with your gut. And I think going with your gut is something that I think is very important that an author needs to do, because typically that's the right way to go. Because like when you just said, when you're writing, you're not really sure how it's going to go. You kind of let it happen on its own, which gives it a lot more realism feel and a lot better read for the reader, instead of just being very, you know, to the point outline, bam, 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 bam. I think readers know it.
You know something? It's a great point, and there's no better feeling for a writer, at least for me, that when a character changes his own fate. For example, in the first book in the series, and I'm giving something away here, but it's, you know, for people who don't know the series, in Strong Enough to Die, you meet this horrible killer who was modeled after the great Anton Chigurh character played by Javier Bardem in No Country for Old Men. A Venezuelan assassin, the deadliest man in the world, named Guillermo Paz, a 7-foot giant who's sent with his team to kill Caitlin when another team fails to. Well, I never intended Paz to survive Strong Enough to Die, but at some point in the book, he decided he wanted to be redeemed. He changed my plans for him on his own, and now he is not just a recurring character in the series, but he's a character that many people say is their favorite character in the series, and they can't picture the series without this guy. And he lends a kind of twisted moral center to what's going on. Now, I didn't make that determination. He did. And by the same token, the fun I have with writing, and why I think my books are fun to read, is because I have fun writing them, is I let the characters dictate what they want to do. You know, I didn't know Court Wesley Masters, Caitlin's significant other in these books, was going to have an old cellmate who's passed on, whose ghost keeps reappearing to him to help him out and help him out of tough situations. I didn't know that the strongest relationship in the series, for many, that was going to evolve, was Caitlin's relationship with Court Wesley's two sons. that she becomes the surrogate mother for these two boys. And the reason, John, that's crucial for the series is that what makes Caitlin a very special character is that she has this constant push-pull. At heart, she is a modern-day, as I said, a modern-day gunfighter, someone who stands up for justice, someone who stands up for what's right, someone who protects, you know, as Texas Rangers have done for centuries, who protects the innocent. But on the other hand, she's a woman who has these very strong maternal instincts. And the great thing about the tradition that, even though these are modern-day thrillers, they grow out of the Western tradition, the rugged individualist, the frontier hero, Shane, starring Alan Ladd, Ethan Edwards, played by John Wayne in The Searchers, Yul Brynner in The Magnificent Seven, Gary Cooper in High Noon. There's so much conflict in all of those characters who are prisoners of their natures. And I think to a great extent, that defines Caitlin more than anything else.
Well, you know, being here in Hollywood, we love rumors. And there's a little rumor going on, and the funny thing is that you actually told me the rumor. So that's even more funny. And there's something going on with Caitlin Strong in
Hollywood.
I've
heard these same rumors.
Yeah, and so let's just put them to bed. What's going on with Caitlin in Hollywood? Is she going to see the bright lights and the Hollywood sign and have the wonderful weather here coming soon? Is she coming to Hollywood?
Well, you didn't hear this from me because I'm not allowed to talk about it. So this is off the record to your 100,000 listeners. All right. So, but and you know, normally I don't get excited about these things. I'm trying not to get excited this time. But we have made a deal with Sony Pictures to option the first book in the series, Strong Enough to Die, for purposes of a television series. Now, normally this means nothing because Hollywood, you know, they option stuff for very little money and then they never do anything with it. In this case, though, it's different. It happened very quickly, and it's the same team. This is the same group of production people who did Justified, the great show that's on FX.
Yes.
And they're, you know, it's like their comment, this happened all within 3 or 4 weeks, and that's very unusual in this business for something to happen this fast. And their comment was, we've been looking for a female action hero like this for years. Where's she been? And the producer who I placed it with, you know, who placed it with Sony said, you just haven't noticed her. She's been out there. And it's great to hear people say, we did this. We did something with Justified that we want to do with Caitlin Strong. And for your listeners who aren't familiar with Justified on FX, it's a show about a deputy U.S. Marshal played by Timothy Oliphant based on some stories and novels by Elmore, the great Elmore Leonard. So they saw something in that character and that author and those books that they liked and wanted to do. The reason why Justified is a hit and hugely successful critically is because they made it true to what was written. And as I look at what Sony is saying, it's all the body language, all the words are the same. They're saying, we want to make this character flawed, conflicted, violent. We want to do it just the way it's written. So I have hopes that if it does happen, we're going to see the Caitlin that I wrote on the screen as opposed to something that I had nothing to do with. I'm just real excited about the possibility, even the possibility, because what this would do for the books and her name recognition, you know, I don't want to, you know, I want to be Stieg Larsson before I drop dead. You know, I don't want to be. You know, it'd be nice if Caitlin Strong.
Yeah, poor Stieg.
You know,
his book.
Yeah.
You know.
And people don't know
Stieg Larsson is the guy with the girl with the dragon tattoo. So just so people know that, you know, he's no longer with us, but now his books are popular.
And speaking of terrific movie adaptations, how many books have had two great movie adaptations made of them? And that's the case with The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. The Fincher version is brilliant with Rooney Mara. God help, you know, let's get someone as good as that to play Caitlin Strong on television, and we're going to have a hit on our hands.
And, you know, and here's the thing, too, that people have to realize when you're talking about Hollywood. First of all, this is probably a year and a half away before they would maybe see, and that's even if they started doing things quickly, before you could ever start to see things on TV, just because it just takes some time to kind of do it. But the other thing is, how much involvement do you think you're going to have? Have they kind of given you a hint maybe of how much involvement you might have?
No,
are you
going to
have any script approval?
I definitely won't have script approval. They'd be stupid to give that to me. But I'm going to have as much involvement as they want me to have. I already have a few notions of how, you know, I hope that they want, I'm sure they'll want to talk to me and listen to my ideas and maybe involve me. The writing process for television is often a group effort. I don't know how the people doing this series or who have done Justified will work with that. So, but, you know, I it's apples and oranges. And you can't, if you don't, aren't willing to let your characters and your stories go, don't sign the deal. I get such a kick out of the fact, John, that when writers like Tom Clancy and Anne Rice, and there have been others, who make $1 million, Clive Cussler, they sell their stuff for millions of dollars, and then they complain when Hollywood changes it. If you don't want them to change it, just don't take the money. Just say no. And Clive Cussler, a wonderful man and a great writer, you know, in his day, he made the mistake twice after Raise the Titanic, which was such a bad movie and lost so much money that the producer, Lord Lou Grade, said, Raise the Titanic, it would have been cheaper to lower the Atlantic. after he swore he'd never do business with Hollywood again, he did it again. He made all the same mistakes when he did Sahara with them. So, look, you can't expect them not to do what they feel is in their best interest. The interesting thing, though, and this is why I'm so excited about television, there was a time, and I'm a screenwriter, and I grew up watching the great films but written by Robert Towne, like the Chinatown, and movies like The Godfather and Marathon Man, which was William Goldman. It was such a writer-driven medium, a writer-director-driven medium back in the 70s and part of the 80s. Now the greatest writing is no longer on screen. The greatest writing on screen is in television. It's Breaking Bad. It's Mad Men. It's Dexter. It's The Sopranos. It's Game of Thrones. You know, I can go on. The Good Wife. The best writing you're going to find on either the big screen or the little screen, it isn't even close anymore. Guys like Vince Gilligan from, you know, who does Breaking Bad, Matthew Weiner, who does Mad Men. These are the best writers in the business today. And here's the reason for that. Here's where film needs to learn from television. The reason for that is they have creative control in television, whereas the writers on movies are the least important element. They're the least important element. I have experienced this firsthand. I have never dealt with so many idiots in my life because they all think they're creative experts on story. They love a script. A script is perfect. And then let's just tweak it a little bit. And 100 drafts later, it doesn't even resemble what you started with, and you get fired because you didn't give them what they wanted. This is the problem with theatrical films today. And maybe, John, maybe it's why there's so much crap getting released, so much crap getting made. You know, how many movies do you go to? When was the last time you went to a film and, like, The Usual Suspects? You know,
different.
They just don't make that kind of movie anymore. I don't know why. I wish they did. Maybe they are, and they're just not getting released, or they're not getting wide releases, or they're going direct to DVD. I don't know. But I do know that the process in television, Sons of Anarchy, Justified, which we talked about before, these are wonderfully, beautifully written shows. And that's what I hope we can look forward to with a series, you know, based around Caitlin Straw.
Well, and this is the thing. So when you have series books like Caitlin Straw, like character like that, she fits much better on TV, which is why I'm really scared about what's going to happen with Lee Child and Jack Reacher because it's Tom Cruise. And the reason I say that is because when you're in film, you have 2 hours to complete a story and show a character. When you're in TV, let's just say you have 10 episodes or, you know, in a season, you have now 10 hours of work that you can totally create a character, create the whole environment with it, take things a little bit slower, but a little bit more detail, which is why series, I think, work better on small screen than big screen. But unless you're doing Lord of the Rings, you're doing three movies to it, that's a different situation. Instead of, you know, if they were trying to pack all Lord of the Rings into one movie, it would be horrid. So that's why I'm more excited that Caitlin is on the small screen than the big screen because of what you said and because of the ability to shine her as a character in more of a realm of, completeness, if you want to say.
You know, there's another side to what you just said. You made me think of something that I've never said on a show or never even thought of, you know, completely before, and that is this. With all the other characters we've talked about, including Reacher, who is iconic, you know, he's the last five Reacher books have been number one New York Times bestselling authors, deservedly so, because they're phenomenal books, and Lee is a wonderful human being. The same thing is true of the Stieg Larsson series. The same thing was true of James Bond. Caitlin Strong is not a household name. So the point I want to get at is whatever they do with her on television, if I'm that lucky, if it actually happens, is going to help define her in the marketplace. She's not already an established New York Times best-selling character. She's successful. These books are bestsellers. They just haven't reached the New York Times yet. So this is going to be a different model in the sense that there's more at stake for me than there is for Lee, and here's why. If they mess up Jack Reacher, which is what the new title is, his books are still going to sell really, really well. If they mess up Caitlin Strong, my books will just sell like they are now. They won't sell necessarily any better. But if they hit the bullseye with Caitlin Strong the way they hit the bullseye with Raylan Givens on Justified, it's going to open up an entirely new dimension for her potential sales, in the sense that more people will know who she is, want to see how she started. And to your point before, because there are so many books and you can't do there, this, you know, by the time the series comes out, there'll be five Caitlin Strong novels. You can't do, you can probably do one novel a year if they stick to that format. People are going to be drawn to read the books they haven't discovered before, as opposed to going from the books to the movies. It's going to be the opposite paradigm. They'll watch the television show and want to read the books, as opposed to being familiar with Jack Reacher and going to see what Tom Cruise is going to do with the character. So it's a different model, John. It puts a little more responsibility on the studio, and you're absolutely right. It's a little scarier because...
Yeah.
If they cast the wrong person, well, then everyone is going to picture that wrong person as Caitlin Strong. But there are so many great actresses out there. If this goes forward, I'm pretty confident they're going to get somebody fantastic to play Caitlin and fill out the rest of the cast. And you know, it's going to be if it happens, it'll be fun and exciting, and more people will get to know Caitlin, and I'll be thrilled.
Well, John, we are excited for you. We are thrilled that you came on with us today. When you ever have any kind of news, please let us know. We'd love to have you back on, see if anything's going to go forward with it. Again, everybody, the book is Strong Vengeance, fourth book in the Caitlin Strong series, and johnlandbooks.com. Just drop the H and you're there. So, John, thank you again so much for coming on, man. Again, keep us up to date on what's going on, and we will talk with you soon. Always a pleasure.
John, my pleasure. I love coming on this show, and every time I talk to you, you've got 50,000 more listeners. I'm probably not responsible for that, so but hopefully someday I'll help you. I'll help you out there with that way too.
That's what we got to do. So hey, all the pleasure, John, and I'll be having my ear to the wall. I'm in Hollywood, so maybe I'll hear some things too. So be good. Catch some wrestling.
All right, but you didn't hear it from me. Remember, this is all off the
record. I didn't hear nothing from you. I heard it all from the Hollywood Reporter.
Absolutely.
All right. How are we doing, John?
Take care, John.
So, again, everybody, author John Land, JONLandBooks.com. The book is Strong Vengeance, fourth in the Caitlin Strong series. You can go back and you can read Strong at the Break, which was the one before, Strong Justice, and Strong Enough to Die, which started it all. We are going to take just a quick break. We ran a little over time. We're going to play the Julie Kramer excerpt after our next guest, which is going to come on in just a second, which is Boyd Morrison. So hang on for that. And in the meantime, listen to this. Back here to our two-hour-long episode of Suspense Radio. We just had the first hour with Tess Gerritsen and John Land, and now we are going to have our next guest on. Author Boyd Morrison, who you might know from The Ark and The Vault, is back with his Tyler Locke book 3 called The Roswell Conspiracy, only out right now in the Nook. So you can go to Barnes & Noble. If you have a Nook, you can download or read it. You can read on your computer with the Nook, everything going on. So, Boyd, thank you so much for coming on, and how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on, John.
So, like I mentioned, the book The Roswell Conspiracy right now is only available on Barnes & Noble because you did the Nook first program. So first question is, what made you decide to go ahead and release The Roswell Conspiracy that way instead of like you did with The Ark and The Vault? What was behind that?
Well, it's kind of a long story, but I'll shorten it, that Simon & Schuster had the Roswell Conspiracy under contract, and when I delivered the book to them, they decided it was unacceptable and canceled the contract. Now, the book is still under contract. It's being published right now by Little Brown in the UK. It's going to come out with Random House in Germany probably next year, and there will be an Audible audiobook of it in a few months. But we shopped it around to other publishers, and nobody wanted to jump into a series in midstream. So I decided to go back to my self-publishing roots and just self-publish it. And Nook First gave me the opportunity to go with that program, which in return for 4 weeks of exclusivity, they promote it on their Nook First page and send out emails to all their readers, and it's worked great so far.
That's, you know, and this is something that authors have to know too, is that, you know, you hit such home runs with The Ark and The Vault, and going back to, you know, Rogue Wave that you had with in The Catalyst with your standalone thrillers, that they have to understand all of a sudden, you know, you submit to Simon & Schuster, you submit the book and something that they didn't like, but you stuck kind of to your guns to say, no, this is the book that needs to be written, which, you know, I commend, and you'd be able to go out and do that. But why? What was the reasoning behind it? I mean, can you kind of say why they decided to do what they did? I mean, it makes no sense to me.
Well, they never gave me any editorial notes, so I literally don't know why it was considered unacceptable. That's really the only thing I know. So they never gave me any notes, never gave me a chance to revise it based on their feedback. So, you know, I just went, and the book was complete. The book that I delivered to them is the same book that I gave to Little Brown. So I really don't know. You'd have to ask them.
I don't know. Well, you know what? Screw them. because the Roswell Conspiracy, Tyler Locke, Book 3, is out now. So tell everybody a little bit about, you know, maybe who Tyler Locke is, if they're not familiar with him in the Ark and the Vault, and, you know, the Roswell Conspiracy, and a little behind the scenes of it.
Yeah, Tyler Locke is a former Army combat engineer who has left the military and now is a chief of special operations at a company called Gordian Engineering, and he has started to get a reputation for getting involved in solving archaeological mysteries. So in the Ark, he was on a search for Noah's Ark to stop a religious fanatic from destroying the world, and then in the Vault, he was investigating a legend from the mythology of Greece and trying to find the gold of King Midas. And in the Roswell Conspiracy, he is called to consult with a 75-year-old woman who claims that she was at the scene of the Roswell incident and that she has a actual piece of the wreckage. And when he gets there, he finds that she's under assault from gunmen who are trying to get that same piece of wreckage. And so he starts to investigate why they want it and what's so valuable about it. And so he gets involved in an adventure that links the Roswell incident to the Tunguska blast of Siberia and the Nazca lines of Peru.
Now, when you're writing something, you know, historical thrillers, you know, like you do, there's always a lot of research that has to go into it. And, of course, Roswell is one of the greatest mysteries that the United States has. Did you go out to Roswell? Did you visit the site? Did you talk to people around the area maybe, have to read a lot of things that maybe weren't classified or things like that to be able to?
Yeah,
I
read a lot about the Roswell incident. And I read about Tunguska, and that, you know, happened in 1908 and still never has really been solved about what happened there. And read a lot of books about UFOs and accounts from people who were at Roswell. And there are people still alive who will not talk about what happened at Roswell. So, you know, in fact, there was a CIA agent who just came out just before the book came out in the UK that said that he claimed he saw files at Langley that showed the Roswell incident actually happened. And so, you know, there are constantly shifting stories, and so I tried to meld them all together into my version of it.
And when people always read historical thrillers, you know, the first thing they always want to know is, okay, what's real and what did the author have to kind of make fictional to round the whole story together? Do you give the readers the idea in the Roswell Conspiracy, maybe, you know, where you took from, okay, this is the actual stuff that happened and then this is the stuff that I kind of put myself into?
Yeah, and I always write an afterword in my stories about what's real, both historically and technologically, because I feature a lot of technological advances, some of which are many of which are true and exist now, and some which are scientifically and technically possible but just haven't quite been created yet, and the same for the archaeological stuff, and sometimes it's hard to keep up. I also feature the Moai from Easter Island, the statues, and link those in as well. And National Geographic just came out with an entire issue about the Moai of Easter Island and how they were moved by walking them with ropes. And that's something I actually put in my book, not knowing that National Geographic was even working on a story like that, or that people were doing research on it. So, you know, it's. I always say it's amazing how little I have to actually make up in these stories. There's also a weapon that is the main threat in this story, and I didn't have to make up the weapon at all. And it's truly scary. It's an electromagnetic pulse weapon, a bomb that actually the military is working on right now. And, no, of course, it's classified, so nobody knows whether they have a working model or not. But if it really existed, it would truly be a scary weapon.
And that's the other thing that people always, you know, we're speaking here with author Boyd Morrison, and the book is The Roswell Conspiracy, which is out now, Barnes & Noble, or BN, BarnesandNoble.com, BN.com, available on the Nook right now for a limited time until it gets more released. That's the other thing, too, when you read historical thrillers and even, like, political thrillers, is when you start involving the government and those types of things, it's always interesting to kind of know. We've spoken with, you know, like Brad Thor and things, when they talk about, I can put some things in and some things I can't put in because, you know, the government has to read it and make sure that I can write those things. Do you ever kind of get that? Do they ever kind of come and say, yeah, you know, you might want to leave that out because we really don't want that, you know, known?
They've never come to me, although I'm sure I'm on some kind of watch list
based
on my internet searches. You know, my main character is a demolitions expert and bomb disarmer, and so, you know, I do a lot of research online about that, and I'm sure I've been flagged by Homeland Security, but nobody has come to me yet saying I can't put something in a book, because everything I use is public domain. So you know, I don't want to use anything classified, because and in fact, sometimes, especially with the bomb stuff, I leave some details out about how these actual weapons could be created, because I don't want to give any, you know, technical data to people,
right,
who would want to do harm to people. No, I've never had anybody say I can't do something. I think that's much more common with, say, ex-CIA people or FBI agents who decide to write books, and because you don't know if they're drawing on stuff they learned while they were in the service.
The other thing that always fascinates me, you know, about the genre that you're in is kind of what sparked you to sit there and say it's time to now explore, you know, the Roswell incident, and have Tyler Locke, your character, be the one, you know, kind of put them into the story. How do you kind of pick and choose which kind of historical things you want to do with your books?
It's mainly based on what would be interesting to me. And I try to change it up with each book. So the first one was a biblical mystery, and the second was Greek mythology. And so I kind of literally went in a different direction and looked to the skies for this one, because I've always been interested in UFOs and the Roswell incident, and, you know, if there really could be alien visitation on Earth. You know, I also read Chariots of the Gods for this, because, you know, of the theory of the Nazca Lines, and were they symbols written in the desert to attract aliens. And so I've always just been interested in that. But when I wrote The Ark, which is the first book in the series, it wasn't because I had an idea for a series. It was just I had an alternative explanation for what Noah's Ark really could have been, and why it was hidden for all these years. And so I just wrote that story, and then I got the contract to do a series. And so I thought, well, why would Tyler Locke, who is an engineer, continue to get involved in this kind of stuff? And I decided, well, you know, it was a pretty big deal to find Noah's Ark, so he'd probably get a reputation for being able to solve these ancient mysteries. And so now people are seeking him out to help them figure out what's going on with these things. So it was kind of a combination of I just wanted to provide a new theory that goes against the conventional wisdom for all of these things. And then also it just would be fun to see somebody who's not an expert in this continue to get drawn into something that really he would have to dig deep to try to figure out.
Tyler Locke is just knocked on your door and wants to come in and have a beer with you and wants to sit down and talk with you. What are you going to ask him?
Oh, I'd want to know all about his adventures and what are the other ancient mysteries that he's been involved in, because I know there's other stories out there that we haven't heard about. He's gotten this reputation based on these major events that probably were publicized, but I'm guessing that there's other stuff that we've just never heard about in public. So I want to hear about those other stories.
And the other thing is have you thought, because, you know, since you are, you know, you're very big, you know, into ebooks and, of course, of independent publishing and the things that you've done in the past and now you're doing here with the Roswell Conspiracy, have you thought of maybe doing, like, any kind of short stories, anything of maybe pulling a character out or maybe kind of doing, like, a short story or maybe a bridge between books and things like that? Have you ever thought of doing that with Tyler in the series?
I've thought of that, and I just haven't. I'd like to do it at some point. I've never written a short story before, so I don't know if that would be something I could actually accomplish, because it is, I think, a different skill. But I would love to do it if I had the right story. The problem is, a lot of times I'll think of something that I would want to do in a short story, and then I think, well, but I can include that in the next novel, so
yeah.
I don't want to use it up in the short story. So it probably, if I did it, it would be about a secondary character, like his best friend is a former Army Ranger that he was in the service with, and now is also with Gordon, and his name's Grant Westfield, and he also used to be a pro wrestler. I kind of based his story on Pat Tillman, who NFL to join
yeah.
the Army. So in my case, he left pro wrestling to do that after 9/11. And so I think maybe he would be a great candidate for his own short story.
And we're speaking here with author Boyd Morrison, and his latest book is The Roswell Conspiracy, book 3 in the Tyler Locke series. And that's the one thing, you know, when you start talking about historical thrillers and like you said, you want to know the adventures that he has had or that he might be going to have. Now that the Roswell Conspiracy is not really like on a timeline, do you expect the next book in the series to not take a, you know, kind of like, you know, normal authors are a year. Do you expect it to kind of be a little bit quicker where maybe book 4 is going to come out? How do you kind of see the timeline of Tyler going moving forward?
Well, I'm still under contract for the next Tyler Locke book with Little Brown in the UK, and so I'm working towards their schedule, so it would be coming out sometime next year. For a series, you have both the familiarity of the same characters, but I try to put a different spin on the characters in every book, and so that you learn more about them. So in the Roswell Conspiracy, we meet Tyler's first love, the girl that he was dating in college, and she comes back into his life in this story. And so in the next book, Tyler Locke 4, I'll be doing the same thing, but it also makes it more of a challenge because you don't want to do the exact same thing that you did in the last book, but you also want to keep what readers have loved about the series and maintain that as well. So, you know, it's a fine line to walk, and that's what keeps it challenging, but it also makes it interesting to find out more about the characters.
And is there one specific scene or maybe just a sentence in the Roswell Conspiracy that kind of sums up, maybe not really sums up the book, but kind of just gives the essence of maybe what the book is kind of about, without giving away any spoilers? Is there that scene, that important scene, that important sentence that just kind of you just know you got it, and that's the one?
There's some funny sentences. I think my favorite line in the story is when Tyler and Jess, his former girlfriend, are in a sticky situation, and he's about to crash land, and she is terrified and doesn't want him to do what he's about to do. And he says, well, if you have any better ideas, tell me 3 minutes ago. And, you know, that kind of sums up his attitude to me. He's very focused and into problem solving, but he also has a sense of humor about it. And so I try to capture that as well. But I think the scene in the book that really sums up what this series is like is when he and Grant get locked in the back of a semi-truck full of explosives. And they've got to figure a way to get out of the back of the truck and stop it before it hits its target.
And how much fun is it when you're writing those kinds of scenes to try to figure out the way on how you're going to roll them to get out of it, and is somebody going to get injured or maimed from it, and those types of things? I mean, do you sit down and do you just kind of like write it first and then see how it unfolds, and then you kind of come back and redo it, or what's your like methodical approach to kind of go through those, to maneuver through those?
Some of those scenes, I have a good idea when I write them how I see them turning out. But for instance, that scene, I probably rewrote it 5 or 6 times because of how it related to the rest of the story, and some of the things that I put in there weren't working for the scene, or I added, some elements to make it even more suspenseful. I combine the knowing how in essence I want the scene to turn out, but I also like the serendipity of writing it and discovery in the process and figuring out cool stuff to add to the scene that makes it even better.
Now, kind of off you're just in Thriller Fest in New York, and how did that go? I mean, did you kind of go out and were you on any panels talking about Roswell Tyler and things of that? How was Thriller Fest this year for you?
It was great. I'm actually director of Agent Fest, which is where we bring
in
50 agents and then about 150 authors or so to try to make connections between the agents and the prospective authors. And since I found my own agent at Agent Fest, they thought I would be a good person to run it. And it went very well. We had a great time, and everybody seemed to enjoy it, and hopefully made some good connections between people. And then I was also on a panel about researching international locales. And it was appropriate because I just got back from a research trip for Tyler Locke 4 when I went to England, Scotland, and France. So that gives you a sneak preview of where the next book will be taking place. I've done that with a lot of the previous my previous stories as well. So for instance, in The Vault, I had a car chase on the Autobahn, and I actually went to Germany and drove on the Autobahn because, one, I always wanted to do it, and two, I wanted to get a sense of what it was really like. And so I rented an Audi and got up to 150 miles an hour on the Autobahn, and I've gotten a lot of compliments about that scene. So hopefully that was one of the reasons, is because I actually experienced it myself.
And one of the other things, you're one of the main star attractions here in the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, which you do too, and that's coming up soon. The thing is that what can fans and maybe authors that have never been to these expect when they go to these kinds of conferences to kind of get out of it? Because I always tell people that they need to go because they're fascinating. But what would you say? Would you kind of agree with that? I mean, the same thing?
Well, there's really two different kinds of conferences. There's writers conferences like the Pacific Northwest Writers Conference, where it's really geared towards writing and craft and publishing. And so if you're interested in writing and getting published, those are great conferences to go to. And you can also meet a lot of great authors there, a lot of agents, editors. And so you really learn about the business and the craft of writing. And then there are fan conferences where it's more about how you can find out how authors create their characters and their plots, and you can also meet them. And those really are geared towards more of the fan experience, and like BoucherCon and Thriller Fest, although Thriller Fest does have an element called Craft Fest that is aimed at writers.
Right.
But they're really more about going and meeting, you know, these big time authors like Lee Child and Steve Barry and James Rollins and Tess Gerritsen and John Land, John, who I met at the very first Thriller Fest, and was nice enough to take me out, invite me out to dinner with him, because I had been reading his books since the early 90s, and it was just a real thrill just to meet him and get to have that experience of talking to him. And so that's what you really get out of the fan conferences.
Well, Boyd, I want to thank you so much for coming on. Your books have given everybody hours of definite entertainment. We are so happy that the Roswell Conspiracy found the home you were able to create for it. And then, you know, we're looking forward to Tyler Locke book 4 and beyond of what's coming out, because it's just fascinating stuff. So thank you so much for the entertainment.
Oh, well, thank you, John. I appreciate it.
All right, you have a good one, and we will see you in the future, hopefully at some of those events. And if you have anything, you can always, you know, come back on and let us know. We'd love to have you back on.
Always. Absolutely.
All right. So, everybody, again, that is author Boyd Morrison. Book 3 of the Tyler Locke series is called The Roswell Conspiracy. BoydMorrison.com is his website to check out everything and all his writing. And you can also find the book, The Roswell Conspiracy, right now on BarnesandNoble.com. If you have a Nook, or you can read on your computer for a short time until the book finally gets released out further, and definitely put this one on your list to get. We are going to be back here in a second. Right now we're going to play, like we said, the Julie Kramer audio excerpt called Shunning Sarah, and then we're going to be back on with our last guest, Robert Logan. So, Julie Kramer, everybody.
Josh's mother got home just after midnight. She smiled, pleased to see the mail on the table, even though it was mostly junk and bills. Her son was becoming responsible in his father's absence. Brian Kippers was overseas, on active duty with his National Guard troop, and wouldn't be home for about 6 months. He'd been gone about a week, 8 days to be exact. Every morning she said the new number out loud as she brushed her teeth. Sometimes, if the mirror was steamed up, she traced it with her finger. Brian's absence was hitting his young son hard. At 10 years old, this was the first season Josh could legally hunt. He'd even received a special slug shotgun on his birthday. Now there was no dad to take him scouting for deer or pheasants. Even before the actual deployment, Brian was off training with his military unit, so they had little family time. Once, Michelle caught him lecturing their son on acting like a man while he was away. She stayed out of the conversation to avoid a fight. She'd prefer Josh remain a little boy. Later that night, when she'd brought up not putting so much pressure on Josh, Brian scowled. She'd backed down quickly, not wanting to provoke him. He left the house for a few hours that night, as was their protocol when he became angry. But when he returned, he was calm and gentle. And when they said their goodbyes, Michelle felt that she would miss him, and that when he came back, they would have a fresh beginning, all three of them. Brian had developed a temper over the last couple of years. Sometimes he blamed Michelle, sometimes Josh. She had struggled with doubt concerning their future, but their last month together had been much better. Yet she realized this separation was a crucial test for their marriage. She wanted them both to pass. Michelle had a hard time falling asleep after her shift because the dog kept barking outside. Once she even got up to check for signs of trouble, but the yard was empty except for Bowser. The telephone woke her the next morning. On the other end of the line was the school attendance office.
"Hello, Mrs. Kippers, just calling to confirm your son's absence. Is Josh sick today?"
"What do you mean? Josh isn't home. He's in class." But the professional voice on the other end insisted Josh was not present.
"If he's playing hooky, he will be disciplined."
That put his mom in a panic.
"I need to call you back."
She scrambled out of bed and rushed down the hall. Josh's bed hadn't been slept in, but his backpack lay on top of the covers. Downstairs, his coat hung in the closet. She dashed out the front door, calling his name wildly.
the dog was barking and chasing after her. She looked in the shed. Josh's bike was parked inside. She ran to the barn, the garage, and two other outbuildings. By this time, she was screaming for her son. She knew that kids in the country were vulnerable to perils ranging from rusty nails and grain bins to strange cars along open roads. Not a mother in Minnesota didn't know that Jacob Wetterling was still missing more than 2 decades after being kidnapped while biking home from a convenience store with friends. She rushed back in the house and grabbed the phone. First, she misdialed and got a wrong number. Finally, she reached the grocery store where the neighbor who had agreed to watch Josh worked. Did Josh go to school? The other mother seemed puzzled. We didn't see Josh last night. He never showed up. We thought your shift must be tonight. Michelle slumped against the wall. As the strength left her legs, she slid to the floor in a crouch. Are you there? Michelle, are you there? Josh is missing. She said the last word softly, because missing is such an urgent word, and saying it with a lack of urgency makes it less likely to be true. Her friend couldn't understand her. What did you just say? Michelle breathed deep and spoke fast. Josh is gone. I need to call the police. Then she hung up, dialed 911, and forced herself to pretend she was on duty at the hospital, calmly discussing a patient's prognosis and not the fate of her only child. Fillmore County Sheriff's Office, the voice said. What is your emergency? My son is missing. He didn't go to school and appears to have been gone all night. How old is the child? 10. Do you think he might have run away? No. Her attempt to stay professional failed. I know something bad has happened to him. Please find him now. She told them when she had seen him last, what he was wearing, and answered all their other questions. No, he doesn't have a cell phone. He's only 10. No, he hasn't been upset about anything. The dispatcher on the other end persisted. Have there been any recent changes in his life? A divorce, perhaps? No, nothing like that. Michelle paused for a few seconds. His father left for Afghanistan a few weeks ago, but Josh understands that he's coming back. Then she remembered one other thing worth checking and opened the door to a back hallway closet. Josh's coat, bike, and backpack were all in their usual places, but his gun was gone. She almost dropped the phone as heartbreaking theories flooded her mind. But she briefed the dispatcher about the missing weapon and was assured that someone from law enforcement was on their way. Please locate a recent picture of your son. Michelle glanced at the kitchen clock. She hadn't seen Josh in more than 24 hours.
So again, everybody, we are back, and that was an excerpt from the latest book in Julie Kramer called Shunning Sarah. You can go search Julie Kramer and find out a lot more information about her. And again, if you missed it, you can go back. About an hour ago, we played an excerpt from a book called Ice Fire by David Lyons, and you can go find out about that information. If you have any information, you can always email us too at editor@suspensemagazine.com, and we will let you know anything that we had on the show if you didn't catch something. Right now, we want to bring on our last guest of the day, author Robert Logan, and his latest book is called In Dreams. It's his debut book. So, Robert, we want to thank you so much for coming on. How you doing?
Good, good. Thanks for having me, John.
So, again, your debut book, always a thrilling time for an author when they got, you know, the first book coming out. You're kind of putting yourself out in the public, and it's In Dreams. It starts off beautiful because you've got a great serial killer going on in Colorado, and that's what everybody loves when they read thriller books. Tell everybody a little bit about the book, you know, behind the scenes actions, your characters, you know, kind of the formulation of it.
Okay. Well, In Dreams is a book about a serial killer, but it is different in other suspense thriller, serial killer type books. And the way I say that is because serial killers are scary to everybody. But they all say the same things, if you notice. A serial killer says, I killed all these people because the voice is in my head. Well, I attempt to explain where the voice is coming from. And so it is set in Colorado, small town, small sleepy town in Colorado. My main character is a school teacher. He's not a big-time detective or anything like that. But he has just been told that his brain cancer had returned. This is something that he had since he was a child. And they told him he has 30 days to live. So there is a new radical treatment for him. It's a brand new treatment. And this could save his life, but it could also render him insane or even kill him. But he has no choice at this point, and he takes the treatments. And during the treatments, he experiences these bizarre dreams. He's able to connect with a newspaper reporter named Maggie Roper from 41 years ago, who was investigating a series of murders by a serial killer. So that's the crux of the story. The interaction between Jack and Maggie, the reporter, is fun, let's say. And it was a lot of fun to write. I really enjoyed writing this story.
So what you kind of did is you kind of, and what people have to understand, you kind of took a different approach because, yeah, serial killers, of course, are always very prominent in thrillers and suspense books. But what you've done is you've kind of taken that little extra step by not just explaining, okay, yeah, it's a serial killer and he's doing his thing, but the formation of what kind of made this serial killer the way that he was, which is a little bit different take, because it's kind of not really a backstory of, oh, he had a bad childhood or something like that. It's a little bit more in depth.
Yes. Now, at the same time, there in present time, there's a serial killer who is killing people in the same exact manner as the murders from 41 years ago. So that's my portal to the time travel, if you could say. And, we find out that, Jack is going back in time in his dreams on a telepathic connection with Maggie, the reporter. And since he knows what happens in the past, he helps her in investigating the murder. So it was a lot of fun. It was just a lot of fun to write. I really enjoyed it.
And when you kind of have the two characters, because, you kind of have, Jack and Maggie kind of in the book. And again, I want to remind everybody that, RobertMoganBooks.com is the website to go find out about the book in Dreams. How will you be able to kind of do, the back and forth kind of relationship between kind of Jack and Maggie? Did you kind of formulate that before you knew you were going to write it, or did you just kind of let it do it on its own?
No, I had that formulated, and that's how I came up with – I needed a believable type of story that would give him the power to transport back in time. So I came up with the brain cancer. That's pretty traumatic, a new treatment. That's a new medical treatment that does something with his brain cells and gives him the ability to connect with Maggie. And, it was just a lot of fun to write. And I really enjoyed everything about it.
What would you say would probably be, because it sounds like the chicken or the egg, where you had the characters kind of before the story. So when you're kind of in there and you're in the crux of it and you're starting to write, how much of it kind of surprised you with the book in Dreams, where it kind of maybe went in a little bit different direction than maybe you thought it was going to go when you first had the idea of kind of writing the story?
Well, I wrote the story in about 2 months' time. And when I read through the story, something was missing. So I went back and I added a different subplot. And that made it even more believable because, it's kind of a far-fetched idea, but adding the subplot to it made it that much more believable.
And with those kinds of, like, did you have any stumbling blocks or any kind of writer's block going through? And if you did, you know, how do you kind of work through those things? And what I kind of want to do is kind of show young authors, you know, new authors that are kind of coming out, to not get discouraged. Because, you know, a lot of the times you might be writing a book, you kind of hit a block, you kind of get discouraged, and maybe you leave it to go, and all of a sudden, boom, you know, 2 years later, it's like, oh, I kind of maybe want to go back and do that. How did you kind of overcome all that, you know, to get your book In Dreams?
Well, I really didn't have a block, let's say. It kind of flowed as the story progressed, and the more it progressed, the more excited I got with writing. Each chapter, I really got obsessed with writing, especially the action scenes. Once I started writing them, I couldn't stop writing, and so I never really had a block. I just wanted to keep making the story better, and it flowed really well, and everything came together perfect, you know, in the end.
Mm-hmm.
And it just really flowed really good.
The other thing that we kind of talked a little bit about off the air was your journey on how you got In Dreams published. And, again, a lot of authors, a lot of young authors have never been out there. And, of course, you can just always go out there and e-book it and kind of put it out there. But if you're not a big marketing person or really not kind of sure what you're doing in that, it's just going to sit there on, you know, on the e-book shelf like any other shelf, and it's not going to sell. So you kind of had a little journey, you know, when you were getting the book done. And just, you know, how many rejection letters did you get from agents or publishers with the book In Dreams?
I was rejected 125 times.
And 125 times. And you still persevered through, and then you went ahead and you got to which publisher?
I went through, I found the Peppertree Press Publishing Company, and I had met them through the Florida Writers Association, which I'm a member of, and it was at their annual convention in Orlando that I met with Julianne Howell. She's the publisher, and we talked about it, and she liked the idea and the concept of my storyline, and that's how everything got started. And it's exciting because this came out of the block with great reviews, and I was so excited about it. I'm still excited about it, and all of this started for me really was when my kids were little, I used to take them tent camping, and I would tell them, you know, campfire ghost stories that I had heard myself when I was their age. And so these were stories about the Jersey Devil, and we live in Florida, so the Jersey Devil doesn't really match.
Right.
And so I started writing, making up stories on the different campgrounds that we would go to. And let me tell you, my kids were so excited to hear the story when the sun went down around the campfire that's how I really got started with the writing. And it came to my mind, well, I would like to write a campfire story for adults, a good, scary story. That's when I started writing In Dreams. Everything really came to me. It really flowed in a good way from start to finish.
And now that you're kind of into the author scene, you're kind of doing, now you're starting to make your rounds and you're starting to, you know, have to put yourself, what I always say, from outside, from behind the camera, and now you have to be in front of the camera. How is that dynamic working for you? Because a lot of authors, you know, you kind of get a little jittery at the beginning because you're more, you know, you're very comfortable sitting behind your computer, but now you kind of have to go out and show the people exactly who you are and what your book's about. So how are you being able to handle that transition?
Well, I mean, I do like the writing part the best. But
they normally do.
Right. But this is all brand new to me. It's all exciting stuff. I'm excited about everything. I have confidence now because of the reviews I'm getting and because of the people who actually read the book and have sent me emails to my website saying they couldn't put the book down. They literally could not put the book down. I had one lady tell me she took it on vacation with her, and she could not put the book down. She read it, had to finish reading it on the elevator on the way down to their car. So it's good
nice.
To hear stories like that. And, yeah, so the transition, it's a little tough. I mean, it's brand new to me. All of this is brand new. But I love it. I'm excited about it. And I'm learning more every day. Something else develops, and I've learned something else. And it's exciting stuff. I'm writing my next book now, and I'm writing it with some passion and more confidence behind me. So it's all good stuff.
Now, when you're writing your next one, is it coming a little easier or a little more difficult than the first one? And the reason I ask that is just because when you're writing your first book, you have, of course, a lot of time to write it. But when you're kind of starting to write the second one and now you have a fan base and you're almost under a deadline that might not be a written one, but kind of a deadline where it's, you have your fans are starting to ask you now, where is the next one coming? Is that a little bit different, too? Are you starting to feel a little bit more pressure in writing that one?
Yes, I am. And they are asking, when's the next one coming out? When's the next one coming out?
And guess what? They're going to keep doing it until you stop writing.
Yeah, well, that's a good thing because I love to write. And this is like a hobby that I've always wanted to do. Now that it's a reality, I mean, when I first held this book in my hand for the first time, I got kind of scared. And in that, I mean, I said, well, people are going to read what's in my imagination. Maybe I'm the only one that thinks this is good. And again, as it turns out, everybody loves the story. They love this book. And it's boosted my confidence big time.
And I guess that's one of the main important things is when you're out there and to tell new authors too, you also can't be afraid of, even if you get like a bad review, because they're not all going to be good and you're going to have bad ones. You're going to have ones where maybe people just didn't understand it. But the one thing you have to understand is that, you just go through. You have to keep writing what you love. And I think that the fans will know what's coming through when you're trying to write.
That's true. Look, not everybody's going to love your story. And, you shouldn't have the expectation that, hey, everybody's going to love this story. So, I don't have that expectation. I'm sure there's going to be people who are going to write a bad review. Haven't seen one yet, thank God. But, as a writer, you have to expect that. You have to take that criticism. You have to take that critique, let's say, and just make yourself better. And the only way you're going to get better, I believe, is keep writing. You have to just keep writing.
And I will remind everybody that we're speaking here with author Robert Logan. RobertLoganBooks.com is the website. The book is In Dreams. It's his first book coming out, so he's kind of putting himself out there, which is always exciting, nerve-wracking, and everything else that you have, every other emotion you have going on, because When you're reading a book, you have different emotions, but when you're author and you have other people reading it, you have a lot of other different emotions going on. So it's always fun to kind of see that journey. And is your second book another thriller? Is it kind of along the same lines? Are you changing things up a little bit? Are you do you think that you have found your voice, or is it something that you're still searching for?
No, I believe I found my voice, and I am writing my next one. It has nothing to do with this one. This is a completely different. It will be a
so no series. So no series. It's all standalones.
Yes, standalone.
Okay.
However, the next one, I will make it a trilogy. This is something I've had in the back of my mind for a long time, and I've already written the outline to the entire trilogy, and like I said, I'm just starting now to really dive in and write this, and I'm excited about it. Like I said, my confidence is higher, and again, the writing part is the most fun part.
Well, and speaking of the writing part, have you acquired any, you know, superstitions or anything when you're writing? Have you got to any of that point, or no? Are you not really a superstitious person when you write?
No, I'm not superstitious at all. I just write from whatever brewing in my imagination at that time. And I do, you know, I have to admit that I don't know all of the details of what I'm going to write. I just write and it comes to me as I'm writing. So that's just the way my brain works here. I develop the story, I get more details, and I know where I want to steer the reader, and then I know where I'm going to, let's say, punch them in the face with a twist or a turn.
Right.
That really makes it an exciting book. So, yeah.
And are you secretly happy, like, when you get an email from someone and they say, you know, thanks a lot for scaring the hell out of me? Do you kind of sit back and just kind of laugh and say, yeah, that was my goal. I'm glad I did that.
That's exactly what I say. That's what I'm thinking is, like, I really did want you to be scared. And, I definitely think that.
And so, what then scares the hell out of Robert Logan? You like to scare people in your books. What scares you?
Oh, I don't really know what scares me. I have no fear, I guess.
Do you have a particular, well, besides snakes or spiders, let's just say, do you have a specific kind of author or style of book that when you read, you kind of have the same emotional feeling that you want other readers to have when they read your book? Is there someone or some kind of book that did that to you?
Not particularly, no. Again, it's I have to go back to my campfire story roots and how I told those stories. Even the ones I've written before we went on the actual camping trip was, it was just a short story, but it made me tell it better by writing it all out and formulating a good story.
Well, I'll tell you what, you know, the most important thing that you can do as an author is just, you know, keep the nose down to the ground and, or the pen to the paper and just keep, and, you know, just keep persevering through. And that's exactly what, you know, you were able to do. And that's why your book End Dreams has come out. That's why you were able to be now, you know, on your path to, you know, being successful. And you never know. Don't forget about us in 5 years when you're on, like, the New York Times bestseller list, you know, because we had, you know, we kind of had it on here first.
Absolutely. I will remember you, and I will be on that New York Times bestseller list. I can assure you.
And that's the thing. I mean, when you started writing, and we kind of have, like, about a minute and a half left, so what was, you know, did you have a goal in mind when you started writing? Was it, I want to be a New York Times bestselling author, I want my book to be made into movies or on TV, or I just want to just keep writing and just have fans read them? Did you kind of have any kind of goals or that, you know, or any, you know, it could have been a goal, could have been a fantasy, could have been a dream that you wanted to have when you started, when you wrote End Dreams and started writing your career now?
Sure. My goal is to be a number one New York Times bestselling author. Along with that, my goal is to have my books turned into a movie. That's my ultimate goal. I mean, I'm not going to stop until I get there.
Mm-hmm. And that is, I think, a lot of the goals for, you know, a lot of the authors. And we just want to thank you so much for coming out today and sharing the story. Again, the book is In Dreams. RobertLoganBooks.com is the website. And, Robert, we wish you nothing but the best in the future. We really appreciate you coming on. And, again, you know, you let us know what's going on in the future with you and what you have coming out, and we'd love to talk to you again.
Okay, sure. That sounds great. Thanks for having me, John. This was good. I liked it.
No problem, Robert. Enjoy yourself, and we will talk with you soon.
Okay. Thanks, John.
So, again, everybody, that is all for Robert Logan, RobertLoganBooks.com, and the book is In Dreams. It's out now to be able to get. Go check out Robert, another debut author, one that you will probably, you know, you might want to have in your library if you're a thriller writer. Thriller, more suspense, serial killer kind of books, put him on your library and check him out. We also want to thank all of our guests that we had on. Tess Gerritsen, we had on earlier, Rosalian Isles, of course, fame, and TessGerritsen.com with her book, Last to Die. John Land was on next with Strong Vengeance and the fourth book in his Caitlin Strong series and some other exclusive information that he had on. Then we just had author Boyd Morrison, and it's Boyd Morrison. .com for him and his book, The Roswell Conspiracy. We want to thank David Lyons for his book, Icefire, his excerpt that we had played earlier in the show. And then again with author Julie Kramer and her book that we played, Shunning Sarah, on the show. We are going now to RWA in Anaheim. We will be back here in about 3 weeks, I think. Check out suspensemagazine.com and click on the Suspense Radio button for all the shows that we have coming up. We're going to have some guests coming on. We're going to be filling in some spots. I know Karen Slaughter, I think, the August 18th show, if I have my dates correct, and sometimes I do and don't. August 18th, I believe, will be our next show, and I know Karen Slaughter, a famous author, is going to be on that show. So make sure you tune in, suspensemagazine.com, Suspense Radio. Join us on Facebook, Twitter, wherever. We're out of here, everybody. Thanks so much. We'll see you next time.